Well, hello and welcome back to Failure Piece Theater. I am your amiable co-host, Tim, and joining me as always is...
Catherine!
And we've returned after a fairly long hiatus, where we was busy with stuff. we've been pulled from our pre-spring hibernation slash slumber by a show that has, just... kind of rocked our worlds because it's so good. This is Failure Piece Theater, your podcast for, projects, films, media that may have just missed the mark, right? That maybe didn't hit where it needed to hit. And this show doesn't necessarily meet that core criterion, but I want to talk about it. We want to talk about it because not enough people are talking about it. Are people talking about it? Yes. Is that talk positive? Mostly. But more people need to watch it. And that, of course, is Fallout on Amazon Prime. And golly gee willikers, man, is this show something.
Yeah.
Just real good. I knew from the opening scene that the individuals involved, and we'll get to them, had gotten the memo about what Fallout is supposed to be. And we'll get into it. I think we're going to try and keep this pretty spoiler light. We may have a little segment at the end that we do some spoilers. But we really just want to talk about the overall, I just want to talk about the overall sort of like impression of the show.
Yeah.
What they've done, how they've constructed, quite frankly, a very complicated world and universe into a very watchable show for people who are who, if you're a fan of the game, there is so much in this to satisfy you. Oh my gosh. But if you are not, it is so good, even without any of that context, that I wholeheartedly recommend it to anyone that has an appreciation of sort of post-apocalypse stories. Because, man, this one nails it on so many fronts.
It caused our mother, who is in her 60s, to say, "These are video games, right? Is there one that I could play?" Like, she would like to play a Fallout game now. And we'll do our best to facilitate that.
I've totally offered to help her acquire everything that she needs to do a playthrough of any Fallout game she wants. I think three might be the easiest one to get into myself of the modern ones.
It's the most accessible, probably. New Vegas is the best.
New Vegas is the best, but it's also very big.
To warn anyone listening, we have strong Fallout opinions, and that opinion Fallout New Vegas is the best.
Of the modern ones, it's kind of hard to dispute that New Vegas is the best. I have a lot of affinity for Fallout 3 because Fallout, for all intents and purposes, was a dead franchise.
And then they revived it. And revived it in really grand fashion.
Exactly. That's the thing. Like Fallout 3 was a group of people at Bethesda sort of looking at what Fallout was and then trying to translate it into a framework that they already had. You know, I mean, like really Fallout 3 is just, you know, Elder Scrolls Oblivion with Fallout trappings in a lot of ways. Is that bad? No, not at all. But it made the world of Fallout, the structure of Fallout, the exploration components of Fallout much more accessible to a modern audience. Because the original Fallout games, and I've had this conversation with students over the last couple of weeks in some of my classes who are very into the show and very interested in the games, who don't even realize that the first really like three entries in the Fallout series are top-down isometric turn-based RPGs, right? They are old school RPGs from the Interplay days when Interplay was killing it with their old school RPG makers. Mm. Now, all those people after Fallout sort of, you know, ended and those people diasporaed out. I mean, you know, then you get your Baldur's Gates and your Icewind Dales and, you know, all of those people working on all these other, you know, really great franchises. But the original Fallout holds a very special place in my heart. I bought it on clearance at a Toys R Us while we were visiting family and played it on the computer that I built after I got married, which was technically my first computer. and loved it. Loved that Vigi game, and still have it, still in the basement.
Your copy is the copy that I played, because you were the source of games for me.
Yes, I had the games.
Still a child. And I loved Fallout, and I loved Fallout 2, and I have wonderful memories of those games. I don't know. I try not to be one of those people who's like needled by nostalgia, but I guess Fallout is one of those franchises that'll do it.
Fallout is one. It's because that first game, and it was so good at what it was trying to do. The world it established, it had fairly big name actors in it. I mean, Ron Perlman has been doing the War Never Changes voiceover since Fallout 1. Richard Dean Anderson is one of the early NPCs that you meet. Tony Shalhoub is the guy who runs Shady Sands, which has a huge part to play in this show. It was a big deal, right? Like, it was a significant release at the time. And again, it was the year it was released, in the year of like the biggest games ever, right? Like, I want to say it was another one in that like 1998 time frame, which, you know, we're getting Half-Life, we're getting, you know, all these different things. It was like
Fallout was 97, and Fallout 97. 2 was 98. They came out like one right after the other.
Right. Yeah. No, 1 and 2 were pretty much right after each other. And then we had some of the tactics games in the early 2000s that didn't really go anywhere. They tried to consoleize the franchise, and, you know, it didn't play very well. There was Brotherhood of Steel, which was one of those. Oh, what was the name of those like top down RPGs that were popular? It was a Baldur's Gate series, wasn't it? Dark Alliance or whatever. And they tried to make a Fallout game that was one of those, and it was fine, but it wasn't anything.
I enjoyed it.
Awesome.
I don't think I beat it, though. It was good.
It got tough at the end. It got really tough. And then, of course, everything kind of takes over with Fallout 3 in 2008, where
and maybe the most off-putting thing about Fallout as a modern franchise, the merchandising.
Yes.
The merchandising went out of control, starting with Fallout 3. Yes, they have not stopped.
Understood the power of the Pip-Boy brand.
Yeah.
They ran it to the ground.
I mean, and one thing that Fallout has always had from the very beginning is the aesthetic. Like,
it has an incredible aesthetic.
It has a great look. It has a great feel. And it's a post-apocalyptic world that you kind of want to live in, even though, you know, you shouldn't want that. And that has been fully embraced by Bethesda. They, if you want to live in that world, you can buy enough shit for your home that will make you feel like you do.
Yeah. So I'll be a little bit honest here. I was going through all my PC games in the basement. I still have my Fallout game down there, but I found my manual, my original Wasteland survival guide, the Vault-Tec guide, which served as the instruction manual for the original game. Now, I don't have the original box anymore. I lost that over the years. But so I really just had the instruction manual in the disc. So I kept the disc. I threw the instruction manual on eBay. And I've had it there for probably almost a year. It sold last week for the ridiculous and exorbitant price that I had on it. Because it was one of those things, I'll leave it up here. If somebody buys it for this, I'll sell it. But if they don't, I'll just hang on to this because I love Fallout as well. And somebody bit after this show hit. So it is having an effect, I think. But yes, the merchandising is excessive. You know, I have my Fallout 3 Collector's Edition. That is still complete, with my Vault-Tec lunchbox and my Pip-Boy and, you know, all that stuff. You know, so, you know, it's one of those things that the aesthetic of this show and the aesthetic of this game, really, that the show is so well, so properly reproducing, is very, very unique. So I guess let's lay out the world of Fallout for those who may not know. So in the timeline of the Fallout games, everything about our world is the same up until, you know, the atomic bombs drop on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But instead of backing away from nuclear energy, as we did, as Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer showed us, what if we embraced it? What if nuclear power became everything, and everything became nuclear powered? Our cars, our televisions, our radios.
What could go wrong?
Exactly. What could go wrong? And so we go into this like second golden age. Everything's nuclear powered, but then things turn south around 2050, and we get into another huge conflict over resources with, you know, the Red Alliance. There's a character in the game called the Red Scare. You get to play a Donkey Kong style game based on the Red Scare in Fallout 4. And we start getting into this much larger sort of World War III style conflict. And in the midst of all of that, several corporations rise to the surface, right? So the first and most important for the Fallout franchise is Vault Tech, which is a technology company designing vaults to withstand the impending nuclear doom. There is Robco, which produces all of the automatons and robots that you find throughout the world, as well as a lot of the mechanized equipment that you run across. What's the other one? Is there one Westech or something like that? We see all of these characters at the end of this show. Like, they all kind of show up in various ways. It's just super cool. But yeah, so like there's these huge corporations that are kind of working behind the scenes and somehow exploiting this potential nuclear disaster for profit, which is a huge sort of plot point in the series and the games, to be fair. Like, they're not doing anything too original there. The games have tread this territory several times too. And then, of course, in 2077, the unthinkable happens. The bombs drop. It's nuclear annihilation, presumably across the entirety of the world, leaving the surface of the planet a barren, inhospitable wasteland. And then all of these people who are able to secure spots in various vaults throughout the country live safely underground, awaiting, you know, the day that they can presumably come back to the surface. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. Like, it's probably more complicated sounding than it is, but it's very cool. But what this produces, and I think the aesthetic that you were hinting at, what this produces is this retro futuristic sort of mid-century modern, but futuristic look and feel, right? So it's all this technology, computers and robots and, you know, whatever, but it all looks like it's stepped out of your great, great grandmother's living room in 1952, you know? So just an incredible aesthetic, a brilliant world that allowed, I mean, even in the original Fallout, like, that game just savaged late stage capitalism, corporate culture. Like, it just murdered it whole scale. Mm-hmm. Like, so much great satire, so much great world building, like just an understanding of how these things could be twisted and turned and used against us, you know, by these like dickish overlords. Like, it's phenomenal. There's a reason why this franchise is beloved, I think. But I don't know. What else do you want to add? I think I got a lot of it, but
it's for the most part, it is a satire that pretty much everyone seems to be on board with. Which is rare in games.
That's tough. Yeah. We've chatted about that.
We've chatted about that.
That's tough.
but I don't know. It fascinates me how long the franchise has been going and how many games they have made out of it. And, you know, they haven't all been successful. But I think it's interesting that they've taken this sort of basic idea, this very basic satire, this thing that didn't seem like it would amount to this many games, and they've really made kind of this very rich universe out of it. Because it does, I mean, every game does feel very unique and feel very special, which is, I mean, speaking especially with regards to Bethesda's other franchise, that is That's really interesting to me that Fallout has managed to like differentiate each one of the games so much to where they feel like these truly unique experiences. But I don't feel that way about Elder Scrolls.
Yes, I think the fantasy setting, it's harder to pull that off. There's only
maybe
so
that's
much
it.
Pushing.
Maybe,
I think
maybe
there's
like
only
this
so much pushing, yeah.
This is related so much to the aesthetic and the setting and the themes that Fallout is going with. But it just that interests me that it's able to do so much with what seems like it would have been so little.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. The people at Bethesda who have really invested their heart and soul into this franchise, you can tell that they have thought very, very deeply about it. They understand its importance, right? Its uniqueness. Like, there's really nothing else like this in the video game space. There's no other story being told. There's no other world being built and expressed quite like this. There are certainly imitators, right? There are people that try to do what Fallout does, but nobody's been able to hit that height yet.
Well,
you know,
I think
BioShock kind of got there by doing a lot of similar things, but took it in a very different direction, but had this similar sort of approach.
There is the original inspiration for Fallout, which
Wasteland.
You have to shout out. It's Wasteland.
Yeah. Yeah.
And talk 100%. About games that I want to like so much.
I know,
I
right?
I want to love you, Wasteland.
I own them all. I have them all.
Because you keep buying them thinking like, I'm going to love this one. I'm going to love it. And then it's like, oh, I'm never going to finish this game.
I think a lot of it just has to do. I mean, Wasteland also has sort of a twisted and black sense of humor, which I do enjoy. But I don't know. It just plays so much better in the Fallout games. Like, because the original Fallout game is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like the text scroll that it gives you when you look at stuff and it changes based upon your character's stats. So you can make your character just be like a complete moron, right? You can just give him zero intelligence and he doesn't understand anything. So, I mean, you ask him to observe an item and he's like, I don't know what that is. And then you have click on it again. He's like, I still don't know. Like, it's just that kind of humor. It's great. And even the modern games carry that through. Like you can't really do that in 4. In 4, there's like a base capability that every character has, but you know, you can really sort of play the original Fallout. And again, this was how RPGs used to be designed, where like the character that you build determines the game that you get to play, right? Like, you know, if your character is like a big melee fighter that's just really strong but doesn't have much intelligence, like you're not going to be talking your way out of problems. You're not going to be able to express yourself clearly to people. Like, you're just going to be fighting the whole game and you're going to be beating everybody to death with a hammer or something. And it's really cool. And I really love there. I've already seen the people. I think even Bethesda put out character stat sheets for all of the characters in this game so that you could go make a character that behaves like them in Fallout 4, presumably.
Man, this is a game that markets itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool. But yeah, so, you know, we say all that to say the people who were creating this show had a wealth of information to draw from. But we have seen over and over again in the process of adaptation from one medium to another, be it from book or comic book or video game to screen, you get your Wes Anderson, your Paul W.S. Anderson's Resident Evils, and then you get stuff like this.
What's that supposed to mean?
I like the first Resident Evil. I have that entire series in digital 4K. I bought it on sale somewhere. I watched the whole thing through about 3 months ago, right? So it's pretty fresh in the mind. And that series starts off just fine. The first movie is a fine little Resident Evil thingy. The second movie is a disaster of epic proportions. The third movie rights the ship barely. And then the fourth movie walks up to the edge of a cliff and then just leaps headlong off of it with no idea where it's going or what it's going to do. And then it ends in a giant wet explosion of farts. that series is nuts.
They remind me a little bit of if you had a dream about Resident Evil while you were having a fever.
Yeah.
And you're hallucinating. Right. And then when you wake up, you're like, I'm so glad that's not real.
And for some reason, that guy from Game of Thrones is there and he just doesn't leave. He just keeps coming back for the paycheck, I guess. It's just so strange. No, I mean, like, again, most of the time when adapting, authors, creators, directors, writers, they want to put their stamp on it, right? And admittedly so, it's their project. But with this one, I feel like they've done that. These characters they've created, the little sort of areas that they've pushed into inside of the world of Fallout to find new stories to tell were so great. But yet they did all of that without feeling the need to be like, well, does a Pip-Boy have to actually look like that? Couldn't it just be a thing they carry in their pocket? Or do vaults have to look like vaults in the games? Couldn't they just be like white hallways? We built all the sets for Severance already. Could we just use those and call them vaults? Like the kind of things that generally happen in adaptations like this just didn't happen here. And apparently it was very collaborative. I mean, Todd Howard is listed as a producer. I'm sure that was just somewhere in the sales agreement that Todd Howard had to be listed. But, you know, again, it's just so much of the world is preserved so well and presented so well to the audience that it feels loving, right? It feels like Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, who are the executive producers, the showrunners of the show, Nolan. And I know Nolan, I think he directed two episodes. I think Lisa Joy may have done one. No, I don't think she directed any. So he directed like half the episodes. And it feels like, and I don't know Jonathan Nolan, obviously, but we're kind of the same age, pretty close. I think I'm a little bit older than him. And it just feels like he also was that kid sitting in front of a computer playing Fallout 1 in 1998 and or 1997 and being like, oh, this is cool. Like just, it has that feel to it because it's so good at expressing this world immediately. Like I said, I cannot express how I instantly knew that this was going to be great. Like within moments of the first shot. I mean, the first shot also has Walt Goggins in it, so that helps.
I was about to say, I'm like you know, they kicked it off with the right person.
And they did. If it had started in the vault with Lucy, I think it would have taken a little bit longer for me to get into it. Just a bit.
She's not immediately likable, because she is likable. She's adorable. But
right.
You don't know what the hell's going on with the vaults. So I'm so exactly. glad it didn't start there. It had to start before, and it had to give us something before.
Yes.
To contextualize a little bit.
What is this? Right. So I guess we'll lay out the story of the show. Again, we'll avoid spoilers. Most of this is pretty standard information if you've looked at anything about the show. But the show itself is really centered on three core individuals that come from very different worlds within Fallout. Right. So, the center of Fallout, the original Fallout, begins with a character known only as the Vault Dweller being asked to leave Vault 13 in Southern California, or what used to be Southern California, because the water chip inside of their vault has failed. And you have been tasked with making the surface travel to Vault 14 nearby in order to obtain a new water chip so that your vault can continue to run. And there's a time limit on this, which is affected in the game. You have like, what is it, 6 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. And so this show has a vault dweller named Lucy McLean, who lives in vault, what is her vault, 33, which is a tri-vault arrangement, which I think was mentioned in one of the other games. I think it was referenced in a piece of computer, or like a thing you find on a computer in one of the other games. But it's a tri-vault that is paired with Vault 31, 32, and 33, and they all link together underground, right? You don't have to go to the surface to get from one to the other. Then we have Maximus, who is an aspirant in the Brotherhood of Steel. basically a you know, private in the Brotherhood of Steel monastic military, which I did see some stuff about that too, like people trying to say that they didn't know that the Brotherhood of Steel was like a religious organization, which again, okay. media literacy is dead.
I mean, like what?
How can you play any of the Fallout games?
I'm pretty
and not
sure
know?
they would not have used the term brotherhood if they weren't at least angling toward religion. Yeah, just a little bit.
I mean, it's
pretty
scribes,
obvious.
It's scribes, yes. It's monks, it's abbots. Like, I mean, okay. Anyway, but yes, so he is an aspirant and he becomes our window into the world of the Brotherhood of Steel and their knights in power
and
armor.
He is so cute.
Yeah.
I know we're not quite to talking about it, but I don't know anything about Aaron Moten, is his name?
I believe so, yeah.
Wow. He's great. Like, great character. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, no, he's really good. He was the one that took me a little bit longer to get on. I've seen people complaining about him, and I instantly recognize him, like, oh, you know, I mentioned earlier, sort of like you can in the game, you can craft just like a big dumb lug who just runs around and he's our big dumb lug, right? Like he's well-meaning and well-intentioned.
He's a little bit complicated.
He's got some complicated history that gets played out and teased out over the season that does give him some significant depth, but he makes bad choices. And I love characters that are okay. Or I love showrunners and creators who are okay with having characters that make bad choices because they need to, right? These characters, the whole message of this season of the show, or at least the first chunk of it, is that nobody gets out of the wasteland unscathed. You are going to have to sacrifice. You're going to have to change and adapt to live here. Like Michael Emerson's character from the Enclave, which is another group, basically says that word for word to our vault dweller, like, you're going to have to adapt if you want to survive out here. But the question is how much, and can she retain that essential goodness that makes her what she is? Wonderful. So we've got Lucy, the vault dweller. We've got Maximus, the Brotherhood of Steel aspirant. And then we have, oh my God, we have Mr. Walton Goggins playing the ghoul.
Okay. And I know I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one because I've seen other ladies posting about this on the internet.
Yes.
I fell in love with a radioactive cowboy with no nose. And I don't know how that's possible.
What?
Where I'm just like, he's so cool. He's so cool. Wow. And why am I developing a weird crush on him? And it doesn't have anything to do with like the scenes of Walton Goggins in the past. It's
no, and
it's
they are
absolutely
good.
Like, the ghoul. Like, I just love him.
Yes. So he plays a ghoul in the world of Fallout. Some of the people who stayed on the surface, not everyone, but some of the people have become so thoroughly irradiated that they've become these sort of semi-immortal, you know, again, they're referred to as ghouls, but these sort of semi-immortal, half-decaying or decayed, you know, humans. Some of them have retained their essential humanity. In the games, you meet many ghoul characters who can speak and they work and they're part of the community.
Like zombies with jobs.
Zombies with jobs, right? The prisoners with jobs. Right? they're the zombies with jobs. And they're very kind. Generally, the ghouls that you meet, you know, the game has always used them as a mechanism to talk about, you know, racism never really goes away, right? And many of the ghouls live in substandard places, which the show does address. They sort of eke out a bare life, surviving on scraps or eating, you know, whatever they can find. And then, of course, there is the opportunity. They often do go feral, where they lose that inherent, you know, humanity and then just become these sort of more traditional zombies. Again, if in a video game, you need sort of enemies to kill. So it's them sort of playing with that idea. And so Goggins plays the ghoul, and this ghoul is very much, you know, sort of
He's the coolest guy you've ever seen in your life.
He's so cool. I mean, he's the man with no name. He's every Clint Eastwood character, you know, you've ever seen rolled into something even more awesome. And he has a gun that fires mini nuclear bombs. At least I think that's what they are. It's whatever pistol fires like the mini missiles, right? Like that's what his gun is. And it's amazing. He shot a couple of people in one of the first big shootouts. And my wife was like, that gun is awesome. I was like, yes, it is. It's so cool. Now, I would say probably one of the most satisfying storylines of the season that we may get into some spoilers about earlier is that we also find out that the show opens with an actor at the time of the nuclear bombs falling named Cooper Howard, who is sort of like a Roy Rogers style cowboy. He's a TV cowboy of some, you know, acclaim. And he's doing like a kid's birthday party, right? It's the Ghostbusters 2 opening, right? Like, oh, look how pathetic this guy is kind of thing. But he's not pathetic. He's awesome, right? Like he's being insulted by all these idiot dads and he's got his daughter with him who's adorable. And he's just like, it's all good, sweetie. They're just telling me how good of a little partner you are, right? Like that kind of stuff. And he's the best. He's so cool right off the freaking bat. He's so awesome. And then like the unthinkable happens. And it's very cool too, because they work in now again, if you don't know Fallout and you don't know the iconography, if you go look up Pip-Boy, P-I-P-Boy, Pip-Boy is the mascot of the Fallout games because he's the mascot of Vault Tech, right? So if you, as the Vault Dweller, you grow up surrounded by and inundated by, advertising about the Pip-Boy, like he's the vehicle. But the core drawing of Pip-Boy is him with one eye closed holding his thumb up, which is a reference to a very old, now debunked method to know, like, are you too close to an explosion of a nuclear variety?
Explosion. Trust me, right. You're too close.
Right. Yeah. So, and the whole thing was if you hold your thumb up to the horizon and you're looking at the cloud and your thumb covers the cloud, then run the other direction, right? You have a chance, basically. If your thumb is smaller than the cloud, then there's no point in running. And so this is sort of apocryphal lore of the Fallout games. I mean, the people who developed the original Fallout grew up in the time frame where this was a legitimate concern. And these were the types of things we told people to make them feel like you would have some kind of control, that you could do anything about having a nuclear bomb go off in your vicinity, right? That the sort of placating that you do, like to a child, to be like, no, it's going to be okay. And they work that into this first scene and it's glorious. Goggins delivers it. Like I have loved Walt Goggins in pretty much everything he's ever done, but this may be quite literally the crowning achievement of his career. He is so good in this role.
I just love men in cowboy hats and long trench coats.
And it's a good cowboy hat. It's a cowboy hat and just a shredded leather duster, dude.
It's so good.
But he's still wearing the same shirt. I don't know if you noticed.
I did notice.
It's
that.
The same shirt. The shirt that he's wearing when the bombs drop at the beginning is the same shirt that he's wearing, later.
You know he smells bad, but I don't care.
He's got it. So these are our three protagonists who, begin the story in very different places. And then over the course of I thought it would take longer to see their stories intertwine. I really did. I thought we were going to sort of fumble around for three or four episodes before these characters meet. Nope. By the end of episode one, everybody is met. They know each other. We understand the stakes of what they're all going for and we're off. And it was great. I was so surprised by that. Because modern shows just, I don't want to be mean about it, but most modern shows just dick around for episodes, just doing nothing. And I'm like, I'm not a plot guy necessarily. I good character work will always motivate me, but there reaches a point where it's like, okay, we need to sort of get the game rolling here, right? Like you've done your character build up. We know who they are. let's go, and then learn about them as we go, right?
Well, you don't ideally, have to spend, the plot and character development should happen at the same time.
They should be intertwined, right? Because the actions the characters take to further the plot should tell us about the characters, right? Like there's a nice little dance there. Like F. Scott Fitzgerald said, action is character, right? Like character is action. So we need that. And this show gets to it very quickly. I just cannot express how well that balance hit with me. And it was immediately engaging. Like, you know, I was leaving for work. I saw that Fallout was up. I pulled up the first episode. My wife was sitting next to me in the office eating her breakfast. And I said, oh, hey, the new Fallout show's out. Let's check out this first scene. And I mean, like, we watched the first scene. I paused it and I was like, that was really good, right? And she's like, yeah, we're watching the rest of that when you get home, right? And I was like, yes. And then we binged it in 2 days.
Yeah. It took us three, but it was quite literally, we watched three episodes or two episodes and it was like 11:30 and it's like, we really need to go to bed.
Right.
It's like, but I don't want to go to bed. I really want to watch more. And then the next night, it was like, well, let's watch one episode. You know, we'll make it last. And then we sit down, we watch one episode, and it gets to the end. And he's like, do you want to watch another one? And then we watched two more because after that one was done, it's like, let's watch another one. Sure, we could stay up just a little bit later. We made it 3 days. But yeah, I always say I'm going to make it last, and I just can't. TV too fun.
And that is another reason why I wanted to talk about it here, because I'm seeing the debates now of whether they should have dropped it all at once, because, you know, as of the time of this recording, Disney Plus is running the X-Men 97 show, which has also been very good, like shockingly good.
And then doesn't Invincible do like one episode at a time?
I think Invincible, and that's the thing, is like some shows on Amazon, like when we watched the most recent season of Reacher week to week, and it was one episode a week. So I've been seeing people question whether it was a good idea off Amazon in order for the conversation around the show to drop it all at once.
I think I would have lost my mind if I had to wait an entire week.
You know, I feel the same. If I had to wait week to week for the show, some of the intense cliffhangers that they use, especially kind of in the mid-season range, and there are some doozies. I would have been miserable, like, well, so
me in the
miserable.
Vault 31 arc where I'm just like, "What's in the vault? What's in the vault? What's in the vault?" Like I was frothing by that point. Like I need to know.
Yeah, our three main characters, as we mentioned, is Lucy McClane from Vault 33, Maximus, and then the Ghoul. But there is a stellar cast of supporting characters in this show. I cannot think of a single person who does not like just kill it. Leslie Uggams is in this, playing one of there is a fight in Vault 33 for who's going to be the overseer, the leader of the vault. Mm-hmm. And she is fantastic in that. Zach Cherry from Severance is in it as well. And he is wonderful. There's a whole sequence when he's like campaigning for the overseer and he's like, oh man, I don't know how well it's going to
be.
I put up 10 posters. That's like, he's done everything.
Man, a good campaign.
Posters. Somehow Eric Estrada shows up for an episode.
That was funny.
And it was so cool, especially for all you New Vegas fans out there. Michael Rappaport for reasons.
That absolutely killed me. I'm like, there is no perfect person to be the asshole Knight Titus. Like when that armor opened up and I'm like, it's Michael Rappaport. Oh my God.
I was so shocked, dude. Again, a little bit of a spoiler, not really, cause it's like first episode, but yes, like just a really great cast. This is a black comedy. Like this show is black comedy. It is violent. Oh my goodness, it is violent because the games are violent.
Very much.
Even the original, there was a perk that you could get called Bloody Mess, where everything that you killed would just devolve into, I mean, it was pixelated sprites, but it would devolve into this just this pulp, right? You know, and that's been carried forward into the new games as well, where your victims just explode when you kill them. You know, there's a great supporting cast. Lucy's younger brother has a huge part to play in the show, and he's played by Moises Arias from fucking Hannah Montana. But he's great.
He is great, and he ends up being kind of a hero. Like an unexpected
huge,
hero.
Yes. Like the whole first episode is basically Lucy and her dad like dunking on him because he sucks.
He's a disappointment. Like all he does is just stick around on his Pip-Boy.
Yeah, he just plays video games on his Pip-Boy. And there is a really, really good scene later in the show when he's sort of being taken to task for some things that he's done in the vault. And they're like, why do all of your jobs say lacks motivation or something? He's like, I don't know. Sounds accurate. Like, it's very good. Like there's some very clever writing in the show, you know, which I would expect nothing less. The production team on this, as we mentioned before, is Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy with their Kilter Films brand. And if you don't know who that is, Jonathan Nolan is Christopher Nolan's younger brother. He has co-written many of his films. Very famously, he was the one who wrote the short story that Memento was based on. So they have had a sort of, you know, writing and producing relationship for years. Jonathan Nolan has struck out on his own, primarily in television at this point. So he hit my radar because he made Westworld.
Which started out good.
Started out so good. That
and
first season of Westworld...
really
is great. And the second season is good. And the third,
and then the
season,
third season is
More problematic. I liked Aaron Paul. Aaron Paul was fine. But, you know, and then season four was really trying hard to right the ship and was setting things up for a really nice sort of full circle ending.
But
and
by then you
canceled.
Lost everybody.
Yeah, it got canceled.
And then Nolan did The Peripheral, which was a terrible show. I watched that. It was bad.
Yes. I've heard people say it's good. I've heard people say it's bad. I haven't dipped my toes into it myself.
I'm probably too nitpicky. I mean, it had some good things going for it. I bet the book is great. I have never read William Gibson's book, The Peripheral.
I have not read that one either.
Because I go back and forth.
Spook Country.
I go back and forth with William Gibson. Like I love his books, but they're a lot. They're just, you know, whenever you sit down and read one, it's like, okay.
Oh, yes.
The Peripheral was tough to get through. It's got a lot of, like, country people in it and a lot of, like, stereotypes of country people. And that did not... all of the characters were really poorly written. and I don't think that that's sure. probably the book. So I would be very curious to read it. But I didn't like that one. So I admit I was kind of worried about this show. Because I'm like, it could be great, but it could also be kind of lame. Like, it could totally miss the mark.
Nolan's output, while I always get excited about it, it hasn't been the most consistent. And this one, I don't know what mixture was in place. Again, it feels like he just, or you know, he and his wife, Lisa Joy, they had like a really intimate understanding of what the games were. Or maybe Bethesda was just, it just opened up the vault and it was like, here's everything you need to know and understand about this universe and these games. And you know, here's where we can go. It's hard to say, but the quality of the writing on this show is top notch. There were very few episodes where I even felt like the show, I mean, because inevitably in an hour long, and these are long episodes, they are 60 minutes plus, pretty much across the board. And generally you get meandering, right? Like it just happens, right? Characters kind of stand around. We don't know, what are we doing? What's going on? We need to talk about this thing so that people understand this thing in the plot. This show had very little of that. It's very swift. It moves very quickly. And does a good job of bouncing characters off each other, right? Because once they do all meet each other, you know, they all kind of come together, the show kind of mixes up who's with who, right? So we're kind of like bouncing around like, oh, it's Lucy and the ghoul are together. Now they get split up and now it's the ghoul and this other character. And now it's Lucy and Maximus. And, you know, it just kind of gets flipped around in really interesting ways that lets the characters keep developing and keep exploring, you know, themselves and this world. Cause they're all kind of, save for the ghoul, I guess, they're all kind of like babies. Like they just don't know what's going on for various reasons. And part of the show is helping them understand sort of what the world is now. And that worked super well for me. You know, one of the things that you, if you've played the games, you know, is that the vaults were not all what they seemed to be. Yeah. In essence, every vault is an experiment of sorts, right? They were in addition to saving people from nuclear annihilation, they were going to use the vaults as other methods of experimentation to further other goals. And so that kind of becomes a plot point that's kind of interesting. You don't really know exactly what is going on there. But, you know, they've obviously done a lot of looking at sort of how all those things relate to, which is exciting. But ultimately, I think it's the character work that makes this show work really well. The character work and the production design, which is absolutely stellar. It feels like they just gave them the 3D models of the games and then they just made those, right? They just like loaded that up into AutoCAD and were like, make this. It's so, so good. But yeah, so what would you say, which of the storylines worked the best for you? I think for me, it was probably the ghoul overall, but where would you fall on that?
Overall, yes. Ghoul. I mean, I wish that I were just being silly when I say I've developed a crush on a mutant cowboy, but I have. Loved that character. But then, like I said before, I really, really liked the plot, all of Maximus's character and development throughout the show, and how, I don't know, I think the Brotherhood of Steel is really funny. I don't know, I just always found that really funny. Like their vibe is very funny to me.
Yes, very much so.
Very silly. And I don't know, I really, I love the power suit. I just, so cool. I loved every moment that it was on the screen. It was so cool.
Yes, very much so.
So I would say that he was probably the one that worked the best for me. And I like the way that he ends up, you know, teaming up with Lucy. I think that was that they had really good chemistry, surprisingly good chemistry.
Yes, very much so. I guess to get into the Brotherhood of Steel a little bit, they are a monastic order, but their goal is to reclaim lost sort of pre-war technology, right? Yeah. They feel like the future is in controlling that technology, but they have turned it into a fanatical religious quest. Right, like a search for the Holy Grail, you know. So they're meant to be a sort of reborn Knights Templar.
They're very over the top.
Yeah, it's just excessive and strange. And you know, if you want to get sort of interesting about it, you could see it being a framework that they developed to inspire this sort of like religious zeal necessary to go out and put their lives on the line for what mm-hmm. often amounts to trash, right? Like, you know, like I want to say there was a plot line in the original game where, you know, some technology that they've searched for, you know, forever, and it ends up being some like kitchen appliance, you know, it's nothing, but all technology is sacred. So they're going after it. But the thing that makes them unique is that they have, you know, they're scribes, the people that look at the electrical diagrams, you know, and determine, oh, this is a capacitor and this is a resistor and all that kind of stuff. They've been able to recondition pre-war power armor, right? Which in yeah. the world of Fallout, if you just type Fallout into a Google
That's
search
the
engine,
first thing you'll see.
The first thing you're going to see is
it's
a piece
cool
of power
fucking armor.
It has been the cover art of every Fallout game. Is a piece of one kind of piece of power armor. And so, you know, these knights, that's what they wear. That's their suit of armor, is this power armor, the T-60 power armor. And so Maximus is part of this order. He is an aspirant. So he wants to be a squire to a knight, which literally are their horse, right? Like, he just carries all of their shit for them, which is hilarious. Those bags are awesome. It's just this massive bag of stuff that he has to carry around on his bag, on his back for this knight. So they want to be squires so they can prove themselves in combat and they can go through the ranks and eventually be knights themselves. Because obviously there's not a ton of power armor to go around, right? So only select people get to be knights. But the main thing is Brotherhood of Steel has technology. They have weaponry, right, that other people don't have. So we do get a fair look at raiders. Those are the kind of like the primary antagonists of these games, are just like bandits, raiders, you know, people surviving in the wasteland. And it's very Mad Max, right? It's just people with rubber tires for shoulder pads and that kind of stuff, you know. And we do get to see a bunch of raiders in this for you know, several different scenes. And it is very evocative of the games and how they work. But raiders have like pistols made out of PVC pipe, and you know, they're poorly suited to combat. So when the Brotherhood of Steel show up, they just lay waste to everything, which has been a common occurrence pretty much at least one time in every game. There's a scene where the Brotherhood of Steel land in their vertibirds and just like wipe everything out, you know, because they've got that power. But I guess the plot really kicks off with a member of the Enclave in Fallout. How would you describe the Enclave?
Well, kind of like the evil scientists. Kind of? Is that right?
I mean, I'm trying to remember when they came into it. They're relatively recent. They're at the core, the Enclave is supposed to be like what's left of the original U.S. government, right?
Right.
So like the U.S. government that survived the initial attack and went underground, you know, presumably, you know, the president and his, you know, secret vault bunker in a mountain or something. And ultimately, they now are like performing research and trying to like restart that government, which is kind of like, you know,
there's always like
it's like what everybody's trying to do. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, it's after the same goals, but they're the ones doing like a lot of experimentation and a lot of like scientific research, and none of it's good.
Right. So I guess they really entered into the scene of Fallout 2 because they're basically a paramilitary force. Like, they have their own, they have like more advanced power armor. Like, the cover of Fallout Tactics is Enclave power armor that you can get in that game. So it's another sort of paramilitary force. You know, just like the Brotherhood of Steel, they're wanting to restart society. Another faction that we didn't really talk about, but has a lot of importance to New Vegas, is the New California Republic, like basically a new California government that tries to get set up, and is mostly good. Like, they're really trying to do good for the people. There's definitely like bad sides to what they're doing, which is part of the idea of Fallout. It's like nobody is good. Nobody's good. Nobody gets out unscathed. Nobody's perfect. Right.
Like the Enclave, they're the ones who are like anti-mutant, right?
Yeah, I think they're anti-mutant. They're like slavers. I don't know. Like, they're bad. Like, the Enclave is bad.
That's what sticks out the most in my mind, is that they're like evil scientists and they hate the mutants. They hate all the mutations and all the genetic mutation that has happened as a result.
And so Michael Emerson has a great little, you know, it's more than a cameo, but it's a small role. Ben Linus from Lost. I'll always call him. He'll always be Ben Linus from Lost.
I said that out loud, completely forgetting my partner's never seen Lost. And I talk about Lost constantly. I think I'm just going to have to force him to watch it because I'm like, no, you don't understand. It was a seminal moment on television. It was really important.
It was. It was big. Yeah. I
you
think
had
I'm
to
about
be
ready
there.
for a Lost rewatch. I have no doubt it will be very difficult to watch now by
I'm
modern
sure.
comparisons. But man, that was it was the
It was such a special show.
Right? It was the first, dude. Like nobody was like it was event TV, right? But anyway, so Michael Emerson makes a small little play here as a member of the Enclave who is working on some piece of technology that could be revolutionary to the Wasteland, could change the face of the Wasteland if it gets out. And seemingly because they are cruel to dogs, he decides that he's going to leave the Enclave with this technology. At least that's the impression I got, because he's part of like a dog program and he ends up saving one of them.
Because they kill the dogs that they don't think will be healthy enough to use in their
in combat or experiments or whatever.
But
yeah.
Then he saves one. And it's dog meat.
And it's dog meat because, again, this as a Fallout fan, and my family's watching this and they're like, that dog is awesome. And I'm like, yes.
Yes, that dog is awesome.
His name is Dog Meat and he is unkillable.
That dog is your friend.
That dog will be by your side forever. Because in every Fallout game, your first companion, generally speaking, is a dog that is just always referred to as Dog Meat. And if you choose to, you can take Dog Meat as your primary companion through the game for the entirety of said
game. You mean if you choose to? Why would you not choose that?
Well, I
mean,
what kind
of monster
like,
would you be?
You know, Fox the Super Mutant in Fallout 3 was pretty good. That minigun would shred through some death
claws.
Everybody
took the dog. Everybody
loves dog meat.
Now, I remember Dog Meat in the original games was like not a nice looking dog. Dog
no,
meat
he
was scary.
He was messed up. Yeah, he was messed up.
It was like a mean dog, but it was your dog.
Right. Yeah, he wasn't mean to you.
Yeah. And slowly over time, he's been made into a gooder and gooder boy.
He's just a German Shepherd now.
Yeah, it's just an adorable German Shepherd now.
It's the most adorable German Shepherd you've ever seen.
In the show, though, I do have to point out, this is where I expose myself as like a dog person. It's a Malinois. It's not a German Shepherd.
That is true. Yes. Yeah, this is
Belgian
not,
Malinois.
And the show is Belgian Malinois, which are the most trainable dogs. They're the ones used by most special forces dog units around the world. We had a neighbor who was ex-Navy, and he had a Malinois was his dog. And he got to take it. It was his dog in the military, and they allowed him to be discharged at the same time so that he could stay together. So it was very sweet. And yes, that dog was excellent. Never did anything. Never pooped in our yard. Other people's dogs, not so much.
But regardless of what breed you make Dog Meat is a perfect dog.
Yes, Dog Meat's great.
And in the show is also perfect.
He's great in the show. Yes. Like, and I won't spoil anything about what happens and what goes on with Dog Meat. But so this, everybody is trying to find the Enclave guy, right? That's the thing, right? Enclave Man has stuff. Ghoul wants Enclave Man because of the high bounty. Lucy needs to find Enclave Man because he may be able to point her to the person that caused her to need to leave the vault. And then Brotherhood of Steel guy needs Enclave guy because technology, right? So clean, simple, easy to wrap your head around. And even if you have, again, no concept of how these factions relate to each other inside the world of Fallout, all of these character motivations, very clear, very obvious. And again, that to me is smart writing, right? When you're breaking a season, that stuff needs to make sense. Your core motivations for the characters need to be explicit, even if the reasoning behind them is unclear, right? Like we need to understand why the characters are doing it, even if we don't have the full picture of what's going on. So that's great. Obviously, you know, the Vault Dweller, a series of events take place. I like the way that Lucy's introduced in the show, because she's doing like an interview to be a member of a program. And it sounds like it's going to be like this fun school project. Like, because she's going through the list of all the things she does. Huh, I'm a member of the judo squad and I do take some weapons training, but I'm not that good. And then she like gets all all perfect shots. And so it sounds like she's applying for like a school internship or something. And then we find out that there's just not quite enough genetic diversity in their vault. And apparently there's a lot of cousin stuff, which is what they call it. It's really cool after all this cousin stuff to really kind of get the real thing. So, But she needs to get married. And so she's going to be married to someone from Vault 32, one of their sister vaults. And things go badly when that marriage takes place, continuing the tradition of weddings gone bad in science fiction fantasy shows. But who is the overseer of Vault 31? None other than our sweet, beautiful boy, Kyle MacLachlan. Just MacLachlan it up over here in Vault 33. So good. So good.
I love Kyle MacLachlan.
Yes.
I know I'm not alone. I know I'm not the only one. I know everybody loves him, but I love him.
I was so excited to see him in here, and it immediately told me that there was going to be more to this character than the typical overseer in Fallout, because the overseer generally in Fallout is just a barrier to the hero being able to make their way to the surface. Right. That's really all the overseer ever is. And when I saw it was Kyle MacLachlan, I was like, oh, this is someone. This is important. Right. This will be someone important. And I was correct. That's 100% true. But he's just so good, especially at playing these kind of like slightly menacing administrators. I don't know why he has that. Like, he just, maybe it's the chin, maybe it's the smile, maybe it's the hair. I don't know, but
he has the perfect vibe for a character from the vaults. I don't know. Like, it's just,
yeah.
Something about his on-screen presence is like, yeah, you are perfect for this.
He is. So he plays the overseer of Lucy's vault. Lucy is his daughter. He's got two kids. Their mother died years before, and it's just really been them. So Lucy and her father are very close. She's sort of following in his footsteps in terms of science and trying to understand the inner workings of the vault and sort of how things function. You know, so just a lot of really good character work there. And, you know, we don't get to spend a lot of time with Hank McClane, but again, looms large over the whole season, right? Very important to the whole season. So just great. I'm so excited that MacLachlan is able to be attached, involved in projects like this. Like, he's at the point in his career where it seems like he has the opportunity to be just real choosy and just kind of do what he wants. So that let me know that he was excited to be a part of something.
Seems like
this,
he's always kind of does what he wants.
I think Kyle MacLachlan has had one of the most interesting careers as an actor of anybody in the last 30 years. I mean, he's gone from these like experimental films with David Lynch as his backbone, Twin Peaks, of course, but then he sort of segues smoothly and cleanly into just like a soap opera with Desperate Housewives and just all of these interesting bit parts, like maybe not as many lead roles at the end of the day as maybe somebody would have thought, but he's just had this fascinating and intriguing career. And it's just awesome to see him in something like this. And he's so good in it. Like, he has a couple of really, really important parts to play in this story. And I'm very excited for, you know, future involvement if that's on the table, you know? All right. So I guess let's do just a couple minutes of spoilers. We won't go too deep.
We've already spoiled a few things.
We did spoil a couple of things. So let's talk just very briefly. So if you have not watched the show yet, both of us, I think it's safe to say, heartily encourage you to get a hold of an Amazon Prime subscription. You probably have one already. Everybody does. And go check this thing out. It's gorgeous. It streams in surprisingly decent 4K on Amazon service and is well worth it. Even if you just sign up for a month, just to check it out, it's worth it. But a full recommend for me. Fallout is one of the most surprising and enjoyable shows that I have seen this calendar year. It's going to stick with me for a long time. I'm probably going to watch it again very soon, just because I want to play in that world a little bit more. I didn't even say they go to a Super Duper Mart.
Yeah.
And I got so excited.
Yeah.
When I saw Super Duper Mart, I felt stupid sitting in my living room with my family around me, being like, it was 100% the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing at the screen. Hey, there, yep. You know, like yeah. That whole thing. Because I was like, it's Super Duper Mart. Yes. They're like, what's Super Duper Mart? I'm like, it's Super Duper Mart. It's where everything is, right?
It's the thing from the thing that I like.
Yeah. I mean, it's by and large from Wall-E, basically. Yeah. So it was great. But yes, wholeheartedly recommend. This show must be watched by as many people as possible.
Yeah, I agree. And I am excited that people who are into games are watching this show and then going back and playing the first two Fallout games. And
yeah, the Steam numbers have exploded.
Yeah.
On the Fallout.
I repurchased them on Steam because I didn't own them on Steam. I only ever had them on compact disc. So, I mean, it even got me. I'm like, yeah, I'll give you another bunch of money. I've already given Bethesda a lot of my money. I'll just keep giving it to him.
Just keep giving it to him. It's fine. Yep, my kids both started playthroughs on Fallout 4. I gave them the option which one. 4 is on the modern consoles, so it's easy to load up. And we are getting an HD update. Bethesda announced that, timed with the show, apparently. It should be out actually in a couple of days. I think we're getting a full HD update that is adding the Enclave does not appear in Fallout 4. In Fallout 4, he's been, well, they're kind of hinted at, but they're adding another storyline as part of the HD update about the Enclave. You spend a lot of time with the Institute, which is like doing the AI research. That's like the main thrust of the game. And the Enclave's always around. But they're adding some stuff. So I don't know if that's supposed to dovetail deeper into the show. You know, who knows?
I don't know if I want to see things. I don't know if I want to see the games go after the show. I don't know if I want to see that.
I don't think they'd have to.
I like that everything stays separate. Things.
For sure.
But I do want to say that everyone should play New Vegas because it's the best.
New Vegas is so good.
And if we're getting into spoiler territory, if you enjoyed the show, then you should definitely play New Vegas.
It does seem like it's going to be important.
It does.
Like there's going to be some importance. Yeah, so I guess, you know, before we break for spoilers, the Fallout New Vegas was a Fallout game not produced by Bethesda in the Bethesda era. So Fallout 3 came out, produced by Bethesda, hugely successful. They wanted to get another one out the door, so they hired Obsidian Studios, which, shockingly enough, is made up of a bunch of people who worked on the original Fallout games, but now, you know, doing more modern game design. And they killed it.
They made Alpha
so
Protocol.
So hard.
They made Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic 2.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Obsidian is like it, when people talk about the best RPG developers in the world, usually they're talking about Obsidian.
And the Outer Worlds.
The Outer Worlds series, which is their current jam after their relationship with Bethesda ended. They got to doing their own stuff. So they've made the Outer Worlds games, which are available on PC Game Pass. Pentiment, which is glorious. Lovely little game.
I
coming
love,
to Nintendo Switch.
I love Obsidian.
Yes. And Fallout New Vegas, the main thing with Fallout, if you haven't gotten that impression, is choice, right? You build your character, you make choices about what you do in the world. Those choices have ramifications and they carry you throughout the whole game, right? Fallout New Vegas is riddled, absolutely riddled with significant monumental choices that you get to make with your character that radically change the outcome of the game. Whereas Fallout 3 is a fairly linear affair, right? There's little choices you can make, but it all kind of goes to the same place. New Vegas is much more varied and interesting, a much more sort of traditional RPG style. So tons of variety, tons of possibility. Matthew Perry is in it because Matthew Perry was a huge Fallout guy.
He's an amazing character.
He plays an amazing character in Fallout New Vegas.
It's one of the funniest games ever.
Great sense of humor, top to bottom. Much more so than the Bethesda games. The Bethesda games tend to be very serious. Like, they get silly, but they tend to be, the main narratives tend to be very on the, like, oh, this is serious post-apocalyptic story time. And Fallout New Vegas is a little more like, yeah, we're just kind of wacky out here.
Long Dick Johnson.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely worth your time. Okay, so from here on, just a little bit of the spoiler talk. So if you want to watch the show and come back, feel free to do so now. All right, so big spoilers. Fallout New Vegas. Yes.
So squealed like a toddler.
It was
at
pretty
the
cool.
Because I was that's New Vegas. And
yeah, this is where everybody in my family turned to me and were like, wait, what is that?
What does that mean?
That's Vegas, baby.
Well, I was just like flailing and making noises and pointing at the television because I point at things when I get excited. And my partner is playing through Fallout 4 right now.
Yeah.
And I believe he's played Fallout 3, but he's never played New Vegas because it was a buggy mess when it came out. Let's just be honest.
It was a mess. Yes.
Riddled with bugs.
Much
it's fine now.
Now.
It's fine now. And he turned to me and he was like, I'm going to bet that's New Vegas, isn't it? And I'm like, it is. I'm like, you got to play the game. It's so good. And just with how funny this show was, I can only imagine that they will absolutely nail how funny New Vegas was.
Yes.
And I'm so excited. That just really thrills me.
Yeah, I feel like they've demonstrated to me on this show that they have the capability to understand what makes New Vegas work as a location, as a feeling, that they can kind of assemble that and understand what it's for. And I don't necessarily know if the entire next season will be placed in New Vegas, but we're moving that direction very clearly, because I think the timeline of the show, everything happening in the show is after all of the games. So, you know, I'm sure we will see ramifications of potential choices made in the games by some of the characters that you would play or characters that you would meet, which would be cool. There's a lot of possibilities with where they could go. And, you know, with the major reveals that happen in regards to the ghoul's character, which again, I think he gets the most work in the season. Like, he's getting the most backstory. He's getting the most sort of depth, because I really feel like he's meant to be the bridge between these two worlds, right? Because, you know, the technology that Valko created has now made it possible for people from the pre, you know, bombs drop era to still be alive now. Which that's another, you know, reveal of the ghoul. It's not really a reveal, but, you know, he's several hundred years old that he's been traveling the wasteland because he was the cowboy at the beginning. And now he's this other kind of cowboy. And, you know, it all kind of blends together in this beautiful mix of people who were there before the bombs fell and watched all these atrocities happen. And then these sort of fresh faces that don't really have a connection to some of these events in that same way. And that's something the games have never really been able to do, because your character is always that sort of fresh-faced. I guess 4 tries to a little bit, because in 4, he's an ex-soldier, you know, who was at the Battle of Anchorage and all that stuff. So there's a little bit of that bridging there. But yeah, I just, man, oh my God, it was so good. All the stuff with Cooper, the reveal of who Hank McClane is.
You get a creepy de-aged Kyle
McLaughlin. This is some de-aging. Yeah. And it's fine. I wish they had, cause like the whole point of that scene is he's discovering something horrible about his wife, Cooper Howard, pre-ghouling. I wish they had just done like a really deep focus bouquet to like, he's like, his whole world is like shrinking. And then that would have, I think, made it sell a little bit better if there'd just been more like camera effects over it.
Or like they just bring Kyle MacLachlan in there and they don't show his face and they just like do a close up of his eyes and then do like the back of his head. And it's like, I think we'd be able to put 2 and 2 together. That's who it is.
Right. He's got other defining features. You know, you wouldn't have to show it all. I knew it was him as soon as they said Henry the assistant. I was like, yeah, oh, that's Hank's shortened name for Henry. So yeah, I kind of knew right off the bat.
A difficult leap by that point in the series where, you know, something's wrong with her dad.
Right. Yeah. As soon as he was like, okay, you know, because again, another major spoiler, at Lucy's wedding, we find out it's a group of raiders from the surface. So who she thinks are other vault dwellers are there to harm them. And so there's a huge battle in this like inside cornfield that they have. And Hank McClane is kicking ass. And I was like, oh, he's somebody, right? Like he's, you know, he's more than meets the eye, right? Like, you know, there's a real vibe going on with Hank and he is more than what Lucy thinks he is. He is not just the average vault overseer who has fumbled his way through the post-apocalypse. So, you know, I had a lot of potential theories about what that might be and then kind of settled in eventually like, oh, okay, this is what's going on. Which was cool. I enjoyed it. It was just interesting enough. Like even if I had figured it out, seeing the reveal and how they planned it was still going to be interesting, you know? Matt Berry is in the show, which as soon as I heard his voice, I was like, wait, is that Matt Berry? And I was like, oh, cool. Matt Berry doing a voice cameo. Great. And then he's just fucking in it. You see the actor. They have a conversation about how much he was paid to provide his voice to this artificial robot thing. Oh my God. Glorious. And that's why I think they really studied the games. Like, okay, well, like what hasn't been defined? What's the thing that we could push into and say like, oh, this is a thing that we could explore because the games haven't really ever said this is what happened. And they were very smart about those, which makes me excited for New Vegas because New Vegas has lots of places where you could push in and explore, oh, what about this group? Or what about how this thing happened? Or what about like, this thing, you know?
I really hope that they make some time for the Legion.
Yeah.
That was really fucked up. I mean, talk about some violent, crazy, horrible stuff that you could spend a couple episodes on. Wow.
Right. Yeah. One of the factions of Fallout New Vegas is the revived Roman Legion, basically. I guess it was Caesar's Legion, or they call him Caesar. They call him something. Was it some weird version of that? I don't remember. But yeah, you could, and you could join that group. Like you could be one of them, and they were all like murderous people, like upside down crucifying people in villages that they would find. Like,
one of the first towns where you find them, it's like a whole bunch of little like country cottages, and then they've got people like strung up on barbed wire, and they're like executing people on the stairs of like the one public building left in this town. It's messed up.
Yeah, it is rough. And, you know, so either the remnants of them, if this is taking place after, you know, a couple of years after the events of Fallout New Vegas, the game, then we could see the remnants of that Legion still as another faction, you know, that they would fight against. Lots of possibilities, man. Like, they could go anywhere. And that's the cool thing about Fallout. Fallout, like your Star Wars is, like your Lord of the Rings, it's a big world that you can tell a lot of stories in if you understand the foundational elements that need to be present. And I think that this team of writers, you know, with presumably Nolan at the helm, I think they get it. And, you know, there's enough cool stuff that you can work into this series. I mean, I think the creators of Fallout were even surprised at how much could be done with the world they built, right? Like, I don't think they even expected that it would be a franchise that would be this popular and successful 25, 30 years on, right? But here we are. And it's one of those things that the sky's the limit, man. Like, we could go so far with these characters and what they do. You know, the Enclave is still out there doing what they're doing. The Brotherhood of Steel, we've really only glimpsed kind of one group of them. You know, there's just so much, and it's so exciting. The reveal of Lucy's mother and what happened with her relationship with the New California Republic, I thought was good. Telegraphed pretty well. Like, I don't think that was super surprising to me, kind of how all that broke down. But, you know, I really liked that twist that Moldhaver goes from being primary antagonist to being sort of, you know, marginally heroic at the end. I liked that too. I thought that was a good twist that really sort of challenged Lucy's character, right? You could tell that was their goal. Like, what's going to really push her to make some decisions about her relationship with her father and what she's going to do next in the wasteland. And I thought that was good. I also liked that Maximus couldn't stay with them. He had to go back to the Brotherhood. You know, I thought that was kind of cool as well. That means they just have to get together again. And that's exciting to see how all that's going to work. Yeah. So what are your sort of final thoughts? We can probably wrap up. We don't have to go on forever. It's a great show. Go watch it. It's really good.
I mean, I loved everything as far as like the plot development. I like that it's Fallout adjacent in some places. Like, it's not too concerned with fitting in with things that happened in the game. It's like, I don't really need corn in my nuts. these two things can be separate. I like the shout outs. I like the connections to the game, but I don't want to see the things that happened in the game be like one-to-one recreated in the show.
Yeah, no.
However, no. The sets look so good. All of the locations are so incredible and so detailed, and everything is like detailed to the tiniest little moat. Like, everything is so on point with the universe and how everything was supposed to look. Like, I really loved the vault designs. I kind of love just the retro futurist aesthetic anyway. Like, I've always liked that. And just some of the furnishings that they have in the vault apartments were picture perfect.
The quality of the production design cannot be overstated.
Yeah.
It is exacting in its details, shockingly so in some cases.
But I will kind of touch back on my original statement about merchandising. I feel like this show is going to unlock a new level of merchandising for Fallout.
Yes,
because Bethesda loves things and stuff, and they love to sell you the things and stuff that you love. And I feel like they're going to sell everything that was on screen in this show. They're going to be like, do you want that shower curtain with the Vault-Tec logo? Well, here it is.
There you go.
And you know, more power to them. That's the capitalist dream, isn't it? But I'm interested to see where the merchandising will go with this show. Because several times, well, like her backpack.
Yes, that backpack.
I wanted her backpack
awesome.
Real bad. And so I realized cool. that I was being sucked in because about 10 seconds after I thought I had that thought, my partner just pointed and said, I bet Bethesda's going to sell that backpack. And I'm like, son of a bitch, you're absolutely right.
100%.
I will have to 100%. Stop myself from purchasing it.
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. Yeah, like it's going to be big. And piece of me is excited about that because Fallout is such a cool universe. It's such a cool space to play games in and to explore. I want other people to experience that and get into it. And you know, I think I'm going to reload Fallout 76. I played it a little bit last year and enjoyed the time I spent with it. There's like a full story in it now. It's not just a weird empty online Fallout multiplayer game now. But I think I might go back and play it because, you know, I kind of want to live in that world a little bit more. So, you know, it's a great show. I think it's definitely going to be one of the best shows of the year. Pretty hands down. It's an undeniable achievement in unity of vision, right? Of being able to steer a project that has a lot of different parts, a lot of working systems, and make it feel cohesive and whole and complete and satisfying. It's a satisfying narrative. Like by the end of this season, you understand these people, you understand these characters, the world they live in a way that I think is very easy to want to get involved in. Right. And that's great. That's not easy to do, you know? And I think that's, a lot of people have been saying it's easily the best video game adaptation since Last of Us. I would agree. I think overall, as much as I enjoyed Last of Us is a beautiful television series.
It's a bummer.
Very, very good. It's a huge fucking bummer. Like it's a bummer show.
Games were
It's a show about getting bummed. This is a show about being like, that dude just got blown apart by a mini missile fired from a cowboy's gun.
It's a
and
show.
That's a different kind of feel.
It's a show where Fred Armisen shows up and he's a radio DJ.
And he's just
for an old time radio station. He's just there.
He
and
just
that's,
keeps opening
and that's
a
fine.
Little window and looking out and being like, wow. Like it's just the best, dude. It's so good. It's so freaking good. I cannot tell you how great that was when he just showed up and he's sitting there. Cause we didn't even talk about Johnny Pemberton as Thaddeus, the little asshole, just sitting outside and being like, oh, you make some really good traps. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I spent a lot of time. It's so good. Like it's fantastic. Absolutely loved it. Every minute.
Thaddeus, I think you're a ghoul. Oh,
man. I can't go back now. They'll shoot me. Oh, God. Oh, man. Yeah, that's great. So, so good. So, so good. All right. Well, I guess that'll wrap it up. Fallout's awesome. Maybe we'll come back and talk about it a little bit more as season two developments begin. But thanks for hopping on the train with us. We've got a couple episodes to come. So thanks for listening, taking a little bit of time with us. But as always, if they need to find you on the internet, where might our dear listeners be able to go?
These days I am on Twitter, but a little bit less. You might have better luck with Instagram, where sometimes I still post things.
Gotcha. Yeah, we won't get into it, but one of the things that's been going on is, well, you know, the internet.
The internet sucks.
The internet and people on it.
But I'm still on it. I just don't have as much to say lately. So yeah, they finally got me.
Yeah,
they got
internet,
to me.
The internet finally rolled up to your house and said,
the internet finally won.
That's right. You can still give me a T-Baskin. I may be a little bit hard to get a hold of too, but you can always email us at failurepiece@gmail.com if you got a question or a thought. Love to hear from you there too. The internet trolls can't come for us in our private emails, can they?
Nope.
Can
well,
they? No, I don't know.
They can't.
They can't. Good. But you can always get us at FPC Theater on Twitter as well. Okay, well, that'll do us for this week. Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening. And we will be back with discussions of another potentially undervalued or maybe something that you just plain missed, some piece of media that's still worth your time. And we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.